Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, geology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. So nice to have you here on this August the 1st on the West Coast, now August the 2nd on the East Coast Central Time Zone, and Mountain Time is an hour behind them. If you haven't noticed, those of you who are listening in on the Internet, we have upped our frequency. Our sampling frequency right now is at 96K on the high end, so we are broadcasting at 32K, 56K was the old frequency, and 96K. And I got to say, I was listening to the stream right as the music was playing there, and it's the bomb. Let me just say that. Sounds great, Seth. And Don, thank you for the upgrade. It's going to make archives that much nicer and live listening just the same. Of course, those of you who listen to BBS after all the regular shows during the day and into the night and early morning hours, the rest of the time there's music on all the various streams. And you'll hear a lot of promos for the network, and you'll hear some independent music, what's called indie. These artists depend on your support. Their music is really growing on me, I have to say. I'm hearing a lot of people from all over the world that I wouldn't normally hear because the mainstream labels like to promote a handful of artists that they're pushing. They like to make them into superstars, and that's usually to the detriment of the creative artists that never get that big break, maybe because they don't look the part or maybe not even sound the part. They have to be able to be manipulated by the industry, and it's not always the case, but most of the time that's exactly what happens. And so my hat is off to the indie artists. You should make it a point to listen to BBS Radio when you're not listening to a talk show. And no one asked me to say that. It's especially with it at 96K now. You're really going to enjoy it. Well, quick news today. It was announced that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, determined that he had to cut 20,000 government jobs across the state and reduce the pay. I understand it's somewhere around minimum wage of another 200,000 state employees. There is a crisis in California, and they have a $15.2 billion budget that's not been approved. And if it doesn't get approved in the next couple of weeks, California, according to Governor Schwarzenegger, is going to have to borrow money from Wall Street. Interesting, because Wall Street's got their own problems. And we talk about that quite a bit on this show, but we're not going to talk about that tonight. We are going to go into an area that has been highly popular since I've been doing these weekly shows with our resident scientist, inventor, Jim Murray. Jim is with us again tonight, and we're going to talk about Nikola Tesla. Jim, welcome to Evident Footprints yet again. How are you this evening?
I'm well, Don. How are you?
I'm doing great. Just had some thunderstorms roll by, and I had visions of Frankenstein, and then I had visions of Tesla. Not necessarily in that order, but...
Well, I do see the connection. As a matter of fact, when I was a young guy, I was initially interested in Frankenstein, and later made the connection because of all the high voltage equipment to Nikola Tesla. Mm-hmm. So I think you said it in the right order, whether you knew it or not.
Yeah, well, we did a show, it was at least 9 months ago, I would guess, if not longer, on Mary Shelley. And we talked about the monster movies and that, but you had gotten into the technology of cloning and creating life from inanimate forms. And I don't know if you remember that show. It was quite early in the morning. But,
I remember.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that. But I know you wanted to talk about Nikola Tesla, and we refer to him constantly in discussing other aspects of energy and power and alternative modes of producing energy, anything outside of this oil matrix that we're in. And I know that you had some things that you wanted to share, and I'm really looking forward to tonight's show.
Well, good. We'll dive right into it. But I think for those few listeners who may not know who Tesla was, maybe I should take like a 2-minute excursion and just give a little synopsis of who this gentleman is and what he accomplished in his lifetime. Do you want me to do that?
Yeah, that'd be fine. I'll start the stopwatch now.
All right. Well, Nikola Tesla was a Serbian. He was an inventor. He came to the United States around the time when Thomas Edison was king of the electric industry. And he proceeded to muck up the works by inventing three-phase power transmission systems, three-phase motors, and a whole host of other things, which put the DC giant out of business eventually and revolutionized the entire world. Unfortunately, this man is never given the credit that's due to him, and he's downplayed in the history books and even in technical write-ups considerably. He is, of course, recognized as the inventor of the polyphase motor, and little by little, it's becoming realized that he's the true inventor of radio and not Marconi. Is that short enough for you, Don?
Actually, you did it in about a minute. That was excellent. So you have a minute to take a sip of water or a drink of coffee or whatever. No, that was great. Just for the sake, if you can do it in the extra minute that you have, can you discuss the principle of three-phase power and a three-phase motor? And then could we make a quick comparison to DC circuits in that sense, so that the listening audience, as we talk, if we go into a discussion, Tesla versus Edison, something like that, direct current, the difference between direct current, I understand, but you're the expert here.
Well, actually, we should do it in the reverse order to make it clear.
Okay.
The original power source that was used in the electrical industry was direct current, and what direct current is essentially is exactly what the title implies. It's current that flows only in one direction. This is the kind of electricity that you get from batteries, for instance, from solar cells, and from the old-fashioned DC generators that they used to have on trucks and cars back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. The original physics of DC was studied quite early on by people like Ohm and Faraday and others. And it was always assumed that this was going to be the main way in which electricity was utilized, simply because of the fact that the belief persisted that if you used alternating current, which, by the way, was well known, it just was considered an oddity that you couldn't utilize. And as a result of that belief, nothing exceptional was done with AC for many years, until this gentleman, Nikola Tesla, came along and said, well, we can use AC to produce motor action just like you can do with DC. The difference is that, unlike DC, AC can be put through a transformer. Its potential can be changed so that we can transmit that power for many, many miles with very little loss and then bring it back down again to more realistic voltages for local application. Whereas DC, if you ever tried to transmit it for very long distances, you'd be burning out appliances close to the powerhouse, and people at the other end would have a perpetual brownout. So that's the, oh, and the obvious difference, of course, is that with alternating current, as the name implies, the current alternates in the direction of its flow at a rate which is related to the frequency of alternation. So the Americas have settled on 60 cycle power, which means that we alternate the direction of current 60 times a second. Europe is, in a lot of places, is still on 50 cycle. And there's probably other varieties floating around here and there. But Tesla also made a very, very wonderful contribution based on AC, but based on AC in a slightly different variety. And that's what you asked me to describe, Don. That would be three-phase power. Now, in ordinary single-phase power, actually, there are two wires, but only one phase. And what that means, of course, is that the whichever wire you want to consider the hot wire has electricity only flowing with a particular phase relationship to the transmission facility, and we refer to that as single phase. There's also two phase, three phase, six phase, 12 phase, and any number of phases you care to create. But industry has standardized on three phase, which is essentially three currents sent through three different wires, and each one of the currents is 120 degrees apart. And when these currents are properly combined in the windings of a motor that is designed to receive this kind of power, the result is a magnetic vortex or a spinning magnetic field which latches on to the armature of the motor and causes it to spin at a multiple of the fundamental frequency of the line. And so that was one of Tesla's most exciting contributions, which naturally has changed the whole world. You see very little application for DC except in specific industrial situations where it's required. The rest of the world is running pretty nicely on the polyphase Tesla system.
Mm-hmm. Quick question, Jim. Is it the phase that determines which direction the motor spins, or is it something in the arrangement of magnets within the motor?
It's mostly the phase, because
okay.
I can take a motor, for instance, that's got six poles, and let's say it's turning clockwise.
Okay.
And if I switch any of the two phases, it'll turn counterclockwise.
Okay.
So I haven't altered the geometry of the motor at all, but by switching the phases, I can, in fact, reverse the magnetic vectors that are forming and thereby change the direction of the torque that the motor operates with.
Now, it's important. I was going to ask a question. I would presume it's important that in a system, let's say like in a house, it's important that every single outlet in the house and every appliance that's plugged into those outlets is operating on the same phase. Would that be assumed to for no other purpose, for safety purposes? And the reason I mention that is I saw a house once wired incorrectly. And I was actually doing some audio-video installation. It was pre-hung wire before the majority of the drywall went up. And the foreman plugged in a circular saw with a concrete blade, and he was going to cut expansion joints in the sidewalk that was poured in front of the porch. And the moment he hit the switch, the whole saw flew about 60 feet, literally across the yard and into the street, right out of his hand. So, and I know it caused a fire within the wires. You know, it was melting insulation, and it caused quite a bit of damage. So I would presume that would have been where wires were crossed, in other words.
Well, there's so many things that could be wrong. It's very difficult for me to hypothesize what might have happened in that instance. However, for the most part, the standard in the United States for residents is 100-amp service, 240-volt, what they call split-phase service, which means that there are your voltage that's going to be delivered inside the house will be 220 volts phase-to-phase and 110 volts phase-to-neutral. And that neutral is created in the transformer secondary, which is what's brought into the house. And that's the reason why you see three wires coming down from the transformer on the pole.
Yeah.
And you can botch up the connection of things like that, but to be quite honest with you, you know, it's not the same thing, for instance, as connecting a three-phase Delta Y substation or something, which is a little bit more complicated. It's a pretty straightforward thing. So my first feeling might be that either there was a mistake in the voltage that was utilized, or the way the guy wired the saw in or plugged it in, or else whoever wired the house was a novice.
Yeah. Well, it caused quite a bit of damage throughout the house, you know, and of course they didn't get paid for the work. The guy expected to get paid after he was done. He was standing around waiting for a check, and it was just a happenstance event that the foreman actually plugged in that saw. As soon as he hit the power switch, the thing just flew. And I saw it, you know. And, I mean, there was a flame that came out of the wall, too. So, well, the reason I brought that up, not to get you off point here, because I'd like to talk about just the state of the world today and these energy crises that we're in, or this one energy crisis that we're in. And you and I don't buy the reasons for it, and we know that there's a lot more advanced technology and probably around the corner soon for many of us. And my first thought is to ask a rhetorical question. What do you think Nikola Tesla would say about this world today in 2008, specifically when he did the majority of his electrical invention prior to 1900? What would he say, you know, 108 years later, if he saw what was going on, and where would his thinking be?
Well, I've given that issue some deep thought, and I've picked several subjects that I feel qualified to hypothesize upon, just because I know a little bit about Tesla's thinking and the way he viewed things. And those are the ones that I'd like to touch on with you tonight. They are in the following order: electric power, war, government, education, the human race, and Tesla's view of history. And I think that those categories and their subdivisions will make for some interesting conversation over the next 45 minutes or so.
Okay.
Your opening question, of course, is most prevalent, and it's on a lot of people's minds nowadays, and that's this entire issue of electrical power. Now, it's really quite ironic that we are in such a bind with that whole situation, considering the fact that 100 years ago, Tesla tried to outdo his own polyphase transmission system with a more advanced power system, and the financial powers of his time, people like J.P. Morgan and all of his cronies, decided that they were very pleased with Tesla's first contribution, and they weren't going to allow him to upgrade to anything more advanced. And so thorough was their obstinance in this direction that not only did they bankrupt Tesla to prevent him from making further contributions in this direction, but they've actually altered the textbooks. They've changed they paid people to change the gauge factors and the way in which we do our scaling and any number of other things, to prevent, further discovery in that direction. And it's ironic how things work, because now that's coming around full circle to bite us all in the behind. But, of course, with regard to electric power, we've already discussed the fact that he is the originator of three-phase power, which, of course, constitutes the majority of the United States power grid. We do have some high-voltage DC lines here and there, which are primarily experimental. But the basic power grid that most people see on these huge steel towers around the country is, in fact, Tesla's contribution at work. Mm-hmm. Also, I mentioned in my opening statement a little bit about the fact that Tesla was the true author of our concept of radio, even though he would be horrified to see the way in which it is used today. And we had done a whole show on the difference between Tesla's concept in radio and what he wanted to do with it and the way that it wound up being used, which Tesla was fully aware of, but just thought that it was a completely horrible idea to produce such a totally inefficient system as modern radio.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two areas of interest, which we can touch upon in that category, Don, would be automation and robotics, which Tesla is also the author of. Tesla had a radio-controlled, fully automated boat that he used to display in the old Madison Square Garden at a point in time when Mark Comey was still struggling through school. And, of course, then there's the very interesting topic of relativity. And under that subject, we have Einsteinian relativity, which, of course, everybody thinks they understand, and Tesla's version of relativity, which stems from a completely different direction and is really well worth looking into. But in terms of the topic that you chose to discuss, I think that I can sum up very quickly and say that I think Tesla would be very fascinated with the degree to which automation and robotics has been perfected in our society. I think he would also be mesmerized by our progress in solid-state electronics. Tesla was a very much a pioneer in the development of electron tubes. And he did that work long before Thomson, well, around the same time as Thomson, but long before DeForest and some of those other people. Tesla was already experimenting with tubes. Whether or not he ever foresaw that this could be, the same phenomenon could be reduced to a little ceramic block with tens of thousands of micro components inside of it, that I cannot say, but he would certainly marvel at the fact that we've managed to reach that point, and I think that he would be fascinated to see the endless variety of applications for solid-state electronics. But I think he would be immensely disappointed with the way radio has evolved, as I mentioned earlier, and I think he would be astonished that we still have an energy problem when he literally was ready to teach us how to take energy from the fabric of subspace 100 years ago. And I think that would disappoint them greatly. And I don't know what he would be willing to share or not share, but I think he would be really surprised at the way in which the minds of modern people think with respect to these subjects, as opposed to the way that he thought. Because he viewed the universe as an endless source, not only of inspiration, but of information. And if we open our minds to it in the proper manner, there's no end to the information that we can receive, which would then become the basis of an infinite number of innovations for the benefit of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I think he would respond to the topic of electrical power. Do you have anything you'd like to add or question on that particular subject?
Well, it could apply to power, but let's say technology in general, especially the more far-out stuff. Let's say if Tesla was to see a flying saucer or a satellite or anything to do with space or these higher technologies, I probably know the answer to this, but I'm asking this for the listening audience. For those out there that might not even think of this question, but say, hey, that's a great question. Do you think Tesla would recognize, upon seeing something maybe that was developed, after he, retired, after he was gone, if he were to come back today and see certain things, could he recognize its relationship to his work as opposed to being of another source?
Oh, I think so, because, first of all, if you read Tesla's stuff in detail, he has patents on airplanes of his own design. He has patents on turbines of his own design. I don't think it would be too much of a leap for an intellect of his level to figure out that a jet plane was a combination, for instance, of a turbine and an airplane. With regard to the more advanced forms of transportation, like, for instance, paragravitic devices or flying saucers, as you call them, I know for a fact, and so do many others, that Tesla was very much interested in totally electrified aircraft. He has lengthy descriptions in various articles regarding his discoveries in that direction and how he anticipated that there would eventually be ships that could fly in the air but would not be aerodynamic in the sense that they're supported by the motion of air, that they could sit permanently at a particular altitude and just hover with no external propellers or thrust or anything of that sort, and that they could maneuver at extremely incredible speeds and, come and go from the Earth's atmosphere. So I don't know what his ship actually looked like, although some of the earlier renderings suggested some of the things he was contemplating might have been cigar-shaped in nature. Well, we do have cigar-shaped UFOs flying around, but even if we didn't, I think the mere fact that you would see a large disc sitting motionlessly in the air, or zipping along without making a sound and maneuvering at high speeds, I'm pretty sure he would say, oh, there's my principle at work. And, jump to the conclusion based on its performance rather than its immediate appearance.
Mm-hmm. In relationship to where we are today with our technology, computers, for instance, My research led me down the path to discover that Tesla was also interested in that and had been developing some things along those lines. And I'm not sure if it would have possibly been something that was lost in the fire in his New York lab. Was it the 8th Street lab or the 40th Street Lab. I can't remember. I think it was the 8th Street Lab. That invention of a computer or a computing device was given to Vannevar Bush. And he also ended up being one of the original members of MJ-12, which I thought was interesting too. Are you familiar at all with any work that he had done in that area, or let's say with fiber optics, if he had even contemplated the concept of a symbiotic craft or device?
I honestly can't. I can't accurately comment on something that advanced. But to step back a little ways, I can tell you that he had computing and logic-making devices that he had perfected for a number of his inventions. The one that comes to mind most quickly is the guidance system that he used to control his little radio-controlled boat. The system was, for all intents and purposes, an electromechanical computer which could be given overriding commands via the wireless system from the shore.
Mm-hmm.
But the device in the belly of the boat made its own decisions based on the signals that he sent. And that's a pretty advanced concept for that point in time. So, you know, it's the same old story. Given enough time and money, only God knows what he would have been able to develop over the years. But I think that knowing how his mind worked, once he realized that there were such things as solid-state components which operated on a digital basis, and by the way, he had very many things that operated digitally. You know, people have a tendency to think that the idea of a digital device is inherent in things electrical. But actually, the concept of digital computing, for instance, or digital logic, where it's either a zero or a one, mm-hmm. is very, very old. And it made its appearance in mechanics, quite some time ago. So, I'm fully aware of the fact that he definitely would understand the concept of computing by zeros and ones. And then it would only be by, becoming informed about the high-speed electronic application of this principle in solid-state switching devices. I think he could easily bridge that gap with a little bit of instruction to realize that that is, in fact, the nucleus of the modern-day computer. And I think he'd be very fascinated with what's been done in that science.
Mm-hmm.
The speed and the accuracy with which we can determine things. And another thing that he'd be fascinated by, Don, which is related to your line of questioning, is the displays that are now available. Tesla was fascinated by the fact that he inadvertently developed an electron microscope, and he used to watch these particle disintegrations as a reflection on the inside of a semi-transparent globe of glass, which had a radius of about maybe 8 or 10 inches. And at the very center of this was a decomposing button of carbon, which is being acted upon by very high voltages and currents. And the radial dispersion of that from the surface of the minute carbon button to the 10 or 15 inch surface of this globe acted as a lens and allowed him to watch almost microscopically what was happening, you know, at that level. So he was very cognizant of the fact that electronics could be used to produce and display images. And he had investigated the possibility of a device which would behave like a TV camera and a monitor, although he to my knowledge, he did not disclose the methodology behind his idea. But we already know he was thinking about it. And so I think today, for instance, when we see color graphics and these, what do they call these new screens now on TV, the flat screen, plasma screen displays, and all of the computing power that has been added to devices like that to allow a person, for instance, to do 3D graphics or generate solids and move them around in space or do computer-assisted drawing or anything like that, I think that he would be absolutely flabbergasted about that. I think he'd approve of that tremendously.
Now, it's interesting to me that you brought up that particular area because you're reminding me of my research when I was going down the rabbit hole on the George Scherf connection. And I knew that there was somewhere a trail of stolen inventions that would come up possibly under Scherf's name himself. And for the listening audience, in general, Scherf was his assistant in terms of managing contacts between attorneys and certain representatives from the government, maybe the Pentagon or someone in business. And he was an accountant. In fact, I had discovered that he worked for the Union Sulphur Company. I had never heard that before. And I became very, very intrigued by what I found there because the Union Sulphur Company was headed by Hermann Frosch, who was a German chemist. And the association was directly to the Rockefeller family. So they were working for the Rockefellers. And here's a guy whose inventions are not being supported by Rockefeller. They're being stolen by Rockefeller. And I found an invention. I don't recall the patent number of it, but you and I had discussed on a previous show the nature of the drawing, that it was very childlike, or very amateurish, let's say. And it didn't represent any of the other artwork that Tesla had in his other patents. It was not of the standard whatsoever. In fact, it appeared that it was intentionally altered to make it look original, if you get my meaning. Even the description of the invention, it was a lighting controller, and it looked like a combination of a screen and a projector. So he was getting into video, let's say, at that time. I think the invention was the patent was applied for in 1914, and by 1917, it went into George H. Scherf's name. And then I located a George H. Scherf company in Brooklyn, New York, which I found to be very interesting as well, because here's a guy that worked for Tesla all this time, and he's opening his own company while he's still working for Tesla, and he's an accountant or a secretary. He didn't have the smarts or the creativity or the qualifications to come up with such an invention. And to my surprise, Hermann Frosch, who was the president of Union Sulphur, was a witness on the application, on the patent application. Thought that was very, very revealing.
It's interesting you should mention Brooklyn, too, because I remember when I was a younger guy and really started digging into Tesla. I lived in New Jersey at that point, as you know, and I was only a bus ride or a subway ride away from the main public library on 42nd Street, which was practically in Tesla's backyard. And so I used to go over there quite a lot and hunt through their microfilms and their newspaper clippings and all this other stuff, and anything they had on microfilm or any other storage medium to look for articles and information about Tesla. And on one of these occasions, I was extremely excited to find an article. I wish now that I had copied it and saved it rather than just memorizing it or scribbling it down and losing it, which is probably what I did. But it talked about the fact that after the fire, and I'm not sure what lab it was either. Maybe it was even Houston Street. I don't remember. But after his laboratory was burned, a number of his personal articles had been stored in a warehouse in a loft in Brooklyn. And among those things were 15 trunk loads of notes and models. And I never heard another word about that anywhere. And of course, in those days, I had the most excruciating fantasy about finding this old loft building with all these trunks with initials NT on it, and just diving into this incredible collection of notes and data. But that, of course, never happened, and I never did find out anything more about it. But it's very interesting that that would have been in Brooklyn, because in those days, the only real way to get from Manhattan to Brooklyn was on the subway system, which was still quite primitive then, and it wasn't exactly a 2-minute trip. It was a long, drawn-out excursion, especially if it was, deep in the heart of Brooklyn, which is a pretty big, area of New York, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it kind of interesting that that was mentioned and then completely dropped. I never heard another word about it. But what's interesting is there's a lot of things in Tesla's life that were just completely dropped,
Yeah, there was another piece of evidence that came out in a conversation you and I had on a past show, too, regarding Otis Carr. And that was that Otis Carr had gone to school in Brooklyn and studied art there. And I suggested that he may have been recruited to do the drawing, and that he had been around Tesla. He was the individual that was feeding his pigeons, was he not?
Well, he was a guy that, well, when I met Carr, the story he told me was that he, although he was studying graphic arts, I think it was in Brooklyn Polytech or one of those kind of places, he was working at the Pennsylvania Hotel as a package clerk on the night shift. And somebody was always ordering bird seed in these big 5-pound bags. And it was his responsibility to run out and get this stuff. And so he was wondering where the heck all this bird seed was going. Well, of course, Tesla had this love affair with pigeons. And he used to go out in the wee hours of the morning, like 2 or 3 o'clock, into Bryant Park. And the pigeons would actually come and wait for him. And he used to sprinkle bird seed all over the place and feed these pigeons. And he did a lot of research into it and found additives that were good for the birds, like hemp and various other kinds of seeds and what have you. And he used to call these, I don't know who would fill his orders, but he would call these stores and tell them the mixtures that he wanted. It wasn't just a question of, something cheap and off the shelf. He actually went out of his way to have his own custom blends made. Anyway, Otis Carr began wondering where all this birdseed was going and who was consuming it. And so he made it a point to become familiar with Tesla. And I guess after he realized who he was, that's when he took a personal interest in him. And according to the story, Tesla liked him equally well and began to teach him things, because his original calling had nothing to do with electrical physics. And yet later on, as we all know, he was trying to build free energy devices and spaceships and paragravitic devices, all of which were very advanced in theory, and as it turns out, quite beyond the abilities of Otis Carr. But then, of course, there's the Blue Notebook, which I've told you about many times and which I've seen on many occasions and which I thought was probably the source of Carr's ultimate information. And the haunting question always was, for me at least, was it truly an artifact that he had acquired from Tesla? And if it was, you know, then it should be looked for with a great deal of fervor.
Well, in light of Scherf and my research on that, and the listening audience can go to directlightproductions.com, click on articles, and read the two articles that begin with the words Deathbed Confessions. And the story of Tesla is in there, as well as the real identity of the Bush family. And that's the name Scherf that we're speaking about. It's quite possible that Otis Carr might have been inserted into the hotel staff with the plan to have him befriend Tesla. Also,
well, I guess anything is possible, but what's really interesting is that that Carr would have taken the bull by the horns later in his life and decided to go ahead and attempt to put together a company to build spacecraft powered by artificial gravitational fields and free energy devices for homes and industry, you know, risking the wrath of these people who, if he was working for them, he must have gotten the message over the years that they were certainly not interested in propagating Tesla's knowledge, but rather using it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, in the long run, Otis Carr suffered a fate very similar to Tesla's, although it wasn't quite as grandiose. I mean, he served a jail sentence because of the things he was attempting to do, and, you know, he was poisoned and wound up living a very miserable existence with his wife in an old age facility in Pittsburgh right up until the time he died.
Now, are you saying the miserable existence was because of his wife or the facility?
I met his wife, and she was very polite to me. But it was very strange the way Otis reacted when we were discussing Tesla and all of this technical stuff. She suddenly walked into the room with refreshments, kind of like unannounced, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And Carr clammed up immediately, didn't say a word until she left the room. And then he turned to me and my associate, and he just said, "That's the wife." So I got the impression that they weren't exactly enjoying each other's company, but it's really none of my business.
Well, I don't mean to sound like I'm demeaning Otis Carr at all. In fact, if it weren't for Otis Carr, you would not be on this show.
That's true. We met as a result of our mutual interest in this whole affair, and one thing led to another, and here we are, you know.
Yeah, so, and of course we have Tesla to thank for that. So.
Well, yeah, ultimately we all have Tesla to thank for a great many things. And by the way, Don, we shouldn't forget Tesla's attitude on the concept of war.
I would
like to expand on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to take us off on a tangent at all, but this is all very interesting, and it's interesting to recap some of this information in light of the new stuff that you're about to bring out. So go ahead.
Well, you know that I don't know if Tesla realized that wars, at least in our time period, are all planned and utilized for the enrichment of the few. But he certainly realized that it was morally wrong, and he didn't want his inventions to be used for purposes relating to war. But ultimately, he wound up, you know, proposing various things that would do just that. But he had hoped that it would be more to put an end to conflicts of that sort rather than to perpetuate them. And one of his inventions, he talked about being able to detect ships at a great distance. Some people think it was a precursor to radar, but I personally think that it was a different technology, more involving the use of a concept called interference. In other words, it was like an interferometer. Of an electrical nature, where he could actually, you know, send out a disturbance in the water of an electrical nature, and then somehow monitor the reflections coming back and the change in wave patterns, and make intelligent deductions about that. But his greatest attempt to end the war, or to prevent war, I should say, was with the his pursuits for a death ray. And that that's something that started actually as early as Warden Cliff, but didn't get offered to the United States government until, I think it was 1942 or 43. And that's probably what got him killed, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to that, he was very interested in atomic energy, although his way of looking at it, he suggested that that the energy wasn't really coming from mass. He had a very big opposition to Einstein's thinking in that regard. He said that it might look like it's coming from the disintegration of mass, but in reality, it's coming right out of space itself. And he's quoted as saying this in a number of presentations and lectures. So it's very interesting that he was already thinking in terms of energy being extracted from subspace or the vacuum, or call it what you will, you know, that far back in his history. And in addition to that, two other things that he put a lot of time into, he actually invented a vertical takeoff airplane, and there's patents on it, which you can examine, with the understanding that it would be more feasible to transport airplanes by ship and take them off vertically rather than horizontally. And I don't think that his concept was too well embraced at that time, but it's very interesting that the way he attempted to do this was by rotating the wings while holding the fuselage parallel to the ground. And thereby allowing a vertical takeoff with a slow and controlled change to forward motion of the aircraft. But it's very interesting because a device very similar to that has been built and tested. It actually works that way. I forget what the heck the thing is called. You know, there's so many names for these jet planes. But this was a jet prop airplane with oversized propellers, and it was actually built exactly according to the Tesla patent, where the wings would tip vertically, the thing would take off straight up, and then once it was airborne, the wings would rotate slowly forward, providing a compound thrust, which would propel the airplane in a lateral direction, And then the wings would take over at a certain speed and provide lift the way it would on any other airplane. That was a testable concept.
Yeah, so, one that comes to mind is the Harrier jump jet, although I don't know if that's exactly the same concept. Sounds like you're describing a hummingbird, actually. You know, their wings do flutter rapidly, but there's a little bit of a circular motion in the wing pattern of a hummingbird.
Yeah, the Harrier jet uses a deflection device to put the thrust in a downward direction. The wing does not rotate.
Yeah.
But in the Tesla device, the wing actually twists. It doesn't do this on a repetitive basis. It does it slowly under control, so that it's vertical in the beginning, and then after takeoff, it twists to the front. And there is a jet prop plane with very large propellers that operates exactly like this. Now, whether it's still in existence or not, I don't know, but I was flabbergasted to see it at one time. So I know the idea has definitely been tried. And the other thing that Tesla was interested in with regard to war was better means of propulsion for ships. And he was fully supportive of the idea of electrically propelled ships. And of course, as you know, when I was a kid, I spent an awful lot of time on tugboats, both steam-powered and diesel-powered, and a lot of them were diesel-electric and various combinations of mechanical and electrical propulsion. So I'm very familiar with that, and the whole idea of electric propulsion for a marine vessel is really extraordinary. And, of course, Tesla loved electric motors, and so I'm sure he was very taken up with this whole thing. But regardless of the fact that he may have produced a lot of technology and implements which could be used in an aggressive way for war, his actual feelings about it was that it was a total waste of human life, and it was a real memorial to our stupidity for engaging in it. So he really believed that, and he would like to have seen it stopped or avoided. So for the most part, I would have to say that even though some of his technology wound up being used for aggressive purposes, that was not Tesla's original intention, Don.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question. You mentioned his interest in nuclear energy and his thinking about what actually is occurring, let's say, in a nuclear blast. I've seen some photos of some anomalous events, some 9/11 photos. I've seen some, and you and I have discussed these at great length in some recent shows. And then the UFO photos where we did some photographic techniques, changing the filtering of the photos themselves to basically invert the subject matter so that we could see things that are not visible to the naked eye, and we could see the power plant inside the craft, which is an antimatter power plant, and has to be doing something to the time-space continuum. I'm wondering if there's not, at the time of a nuclear explosion, if there's not, or possibly, you know, let's say generation of an antimatter device, if there's not a clash between, let's say, the time-space continuum and the space-time continuum. In other words, at the moment that blast occurs, would it be drawing, according to Tesla, would it be drawing energy out of the ether into the location of the blast, which would probably cause a tear in the time-space continuum?
Well, first of all, I have to interject. That,
sure, go ahead. I'm not the scientist here. I'm trying to visualize that. So.
No, that's okay. One of the things that Tesla vehemently opposed in Einstein's thinking was the notion of four-dimensional space.
Okay.
I mean, he thought it was an absolute horror that anybody would resort to such a an obtuse solution for various explanations of higher effects in the field of physics. Tesla abhorred the idea, and as a matter of fact, this was one of the major reasons for the big split between Tesla and Einstein. And Tesla's feeling was that the four-dimensional space was a lot of nonsense, and that the real source of gravity had nothing to do with so-called space-time, but much rather was the effect of a true field of force, which Tesla claims to have discovered and actually threatened to expose in a big newspaper presentation or a public seminar of sorts, which he thought would then debunk the entire concept of Einstein's theory of relativity. But for some reason, he never published it. But anyway, getting back to the original question, as a result of not believing in that, we have to say, well, what did he believe in? Tesla said that, to his way of thinking, the universe operated in octaves, and he completely bought into Rutherford's model of the nucleus as being a cluster of small particles with electrons orbiting around it, and likened this to the structure of the solar system with the sun as a nucleus and, you know, particles rotating around it being our planets.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Tesla explained the phenomenon of magnetism and electrostatics from the same standpoint that he did the subatomic his subatomic acceptance of the Rutherford atom, insofar as the electric fields that he made use of, for instance, in capacitors and in his high voltage towers and things of that sort, were effectively the result of billions and billions of electrons being crammed into certain spaces. Whereas he looked upon the magnetic effects that we see in so many devices, including his electric motors, as a result of these same electrons undergoing orbital motion as opposed to being stationary. And this is, you know, Feynman, in his physics books, wrote about this exact same phenomenon, and this is an application of relativity to electrostatic and electromagnetic phenomenon. Well, the example that's given quite frequently is that if you have a merry-go-round with a bunch of kids on it, and they're all holding insulated sticks upon which are charged globes, like little Van de Graaff generators, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
If the observer is looking at the merry-go-round when it's stationary, he will see a whole collection of little electrostatic fields surrounding these charged globes. But once the merry-go-round begins to rotate, the same observer will effectively be in a different reference frame. And what he will see will be a magnetic field surrounding the merry-go-round. So, with respect to your question about the evolution of energy in a nuclear explosion, from Tesla's point of view, I think he would probably have embraced the vortex theory and concluded that this energy was being released from the fabric of space itself or from the vacuum or whatever. Because don't forget, he was a complete advocate of the ether concept.
Mm-hmm.
And the ether being an infinitely large ocean of infinitely fine particles is just sitting there until you disturb it. And so under certain conditions, it can cause the release of huge amounts of energy. Now, the ether theory was retired years ago as far as classical physics is concerned, or I should say modern physics is concerned, but the concept has now been replaced with the vacuum point energy, which now everybody's trying to tap. And the interesting thing about all that is Tesla laid down the rules for doing that, and nobody paid any attention to him. But I think that he would probably say that this stuff was released from that that subspace or that zero-point environment to cause devastation in our own part of the world. But I know what you're leading up to with the entities that were appearing, and I'd like to interject a possible explanation for the way Tesla would look at that. It's well known that Tesla spoke many languages. As a matter of fact, I think there were 7 that are recorded. But he actually admitted that he could read more than he could speak. And one of his greatest interests was Sanskrit and the Vedic writings of ancient India, which go back thousands and thousands of years. And in those writings, even to the modern investigator of today, there are many, many things talked about, including nuclear weapons. But over and above that, they talk about the structure of the 7 heavens, different spiritual entities that occupy, you know, these different layers above the earth, and the origin of demons, and, you know, just all kinds of stuff. Nobody has ever bothered, I don't think, to try to figure out how much of it is based on something real and how much of it isn't. But the fact of the matter is, the writings exist, and there's a very, very strong possibility that Tesla read all this stuff. So I think that, for instance, and some of these huge explosions that we talk about, including the nuclear ones, where you see these entities appearing in the debris and in the smoke and what have you, he would probably just say, well, that those things exist in another plane in the ether, but the violence of this vortexian release sucks them into our world, and they probably persist for a period of time here. But since they don't have any true substance of their own, once the commotion from the explosion dies down, they disappear.
Mm-hmm. Or they seek out another place to find a similar energy or similar attraction, let's say. Well, in essence, you're saying Tesla would have said the same thing that I'm kind of asking, because that's my perception. I'm in agreement with what he's saying. It makes more sense. And just like the gravity issue, which you and I have talked about at great length. And there are other writings that we've discussed too that would imply that this is a possibility. It's been noted that when we use certain types of energy, or when we misuse certain types of energy, we violate universal law, for lack of a better word. We violate the nature, the true nature of the universe and how it operates, and in so doing, we put ourselves in great jeopardy. We put not just the planet in jeopardy, not just humanity, but our neighbors in the solar system, the rest of the galaxy, and who knows what sort of chain reaction might be created with the amount of weaponry that we have, were it all to go off right now. We'd be instantly vaporized. There would be nothing left of this planet, and I'm sure we would do enough damage to other dimensions closely related to us and to the whole of existence that we would really do some damage. We would have lifetimes of karma to repay for the damage that we would do.
I think we already have lifetimes of karma to repay, and that's part of the problem. The, it's interesting that you should bring this up because in the Mahabharata, which is also a Vedic epic, they talk right in there, you know, very plainly about the war between Atlantis and India and how there was an exchange of missiles, which they refer to as flaming spears. And when these things landed, you know, they said it was like the light of 1,000 suns. And the flesh was burned off of elephants, and the lakes and rivers boiled away, and you know, the cities and crops were destroyed, and the air and the water and the earth were poisoned for many, many years. And you know, it's very interesting that they're talking about this so plainly in a script that's you know, at least 5,000 years old, but probably more like 10 or 12,000 years old. Mm-hmm. And what's even more interesting was when Oppenheimer you know, first ignited his first atomic bomb in the tower out there in I guess it was Arizona or Nevada. And, you know, after the bomb successfully ignited, he turned to his companions and he quoted Vedic script and said that I have become, I don't remember the whole thing, but I have become the destroyer of worlds. You remember that very famous phrase?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's right out of that. You know, so there's another guy who was reading that stuff. I mean, why else would Oppenheimer, who is a recognized nuclear physicist, know a line of poetry from, you know, from an ancient writing that has nothing, at least doesn't appear to have anything to do with nuclear physics? But there it is. So, yeah, I think the world has probably been, I don't know about totally destroyed, but certainly altered in its normal course more than once in our past history. And I think that if we're not careful, we have more of that to look forward to. Not necessarily from nuclear war, but you know, there are many ways for the planet to be destroyed. And a lot of them Mother Nature can supply herself. And we talked about that on I don't know how many shows.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, you know, it's interesting now, you, at the outset of your dissertation tonight, we'll call it, or your lecture, you alluded to the octaves, and, you know, I tuned into that right away, because, yes, this is a very true thing, it's a matter of frequency, and although there are a lot of high-frequency waves being generated, both light and sound, and on a molecular level, I would presume, and I'm speaking about a nuclear explosion or an atomic explosion, there is definitely a dichotomy between the two frequencies that are interacting, I would say. In other words, you have this massive low base frequency of the explosion itself, immediately tapping into another frequency, octaves higher, maybe even beyond light. Okay, it would be the medium through which light passes, and still is part of the same substance, just a different frequency. But maybe a much higher frequency than light, and so you have these two opposites occurring at the same time, which could only cause destruction. And I think that may be the principle behind everything that we use in warfare, particularly in explosives or certain types of weapons that, again, violate universal law in combining two aspects of or two extremes of the same substance, for lack of a better word. Because what is an octave? If it's sound, it's merely the same sound or a similar wave pattern at a different frequency. Or it could be a distinctly different wave pattern, right? And it could be the same with light or in the ether. I don't know if that makes sense.
Of course it makes sense. And the thing is, too, the concept of octave can also be looked upon in a slightly different way, not just from frequencies point of view, as you pointed out, but also from the standpoint of functionalism. Like, for instance, I'll give you an example. We live on the surface of the planet, and in our atmosphere there are creatures we call birds, and they fly around in the air. But if we were underwater, standing there in a diving suit, the equivalent to the bird is the fish. So it's a different octave of the same concept. You know what I mean?
If it's a flying fish?
Well, that's a perfect example of shifting between dimensions, you know. I mean, almost anything you can dream up, nature has already done it, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm just being a smart aleck here.
Well, yeah, okay, I can handle it.
Well, Jim, we're out of time. This has been fascinating. I would like to continue this next week if we could do that.
Absolutely, no problem.
We could pick up either with the bird or the deep sea diver or the flying fish. It's up to you.
I think I would prefer to stick to the original outline and go back to what Tesla was thinking about the rest of the things in our world.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I hate to cut it short. It is interesting, and we both know that we could go on for another hour or more, but we've got to let Seth get home for the night. So I want to thank you. It's been very enlightening. I've learned a lot tonight, and I'm learning when to shut my mouth. And I appreciate all the information that you brought forth, and I'm sure the listening audience does too.
Well, it's always my pleasure, Don. I love working with you. You know that. And I hope that the few tidbits I can throw out there are well-received and informative and entertaining and all that good stuff.
Well, next week we're going to get into, I know, more advanced power systems and different ways of dealing with our problems. And so I'm looking forward to next week's lecture as well. And I want to thank you.
All right, Don. I'll do my best for you. You take care.
Okay, you too. You have a good night, and we're going to say good night to our listening audience. You have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. Our special guest, Jim Murray, is our weekly science advisor, weekly guest, and he will be back again next Friday for your entertainment, your information, and listening pleasure. Special thanks go out to Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and to Seth Hendrick on the sound. And in the meantime, I want to wish everyone a great weekend. Have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.